Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Thurman Maple Days. Celebrate flowing of sap in the Adirondacks, self-guiding to seven sites for talks, tours, tastes, and old-fashioned friendliness. For more information, visit ThurmanMapleDays.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday. This time a little late, well, you know, whatever, but noonish to like...
Late? This is your normal time.
Well, but I feel like it's late because we have a guest today.
That's true.
On the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, joined as usual with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
We got Jackie Molecules in the booth. How you doing?
I'm great. Just got back from Charleston.
Oh, yeah? How was it?
It was good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I got there early and drove through the Lowcountry to all those weird little islands.
Well, let's talk about that in a second. We have special guest in the studio, the maestro of the Food Lab, which sold how many billion copies did you sell that, Kenji?
Not quite a billion yet, but we're working on it. Yeah. Working on it.
Kenji Lopez, all billion selling book, New York Times bestseller though, right?
Yeah, for a little while.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I think it was something like a billion. In fact, we share a publisher and
an editor.
Oh, that's how I meant. Yeah, an editor. Yeah. I think of her as like the whole, the kind of
right,
edifice,
right.
Maria Guarnaschelli, you know, world-renowned editor. Anyway, so like the success of your book actually got her off my back for a while because she's wasn't for a while worried about my second book because of the enormous success.
Do you have a second book coming? Or?
Yes.
Cocktails also?
No cocktails. No cocktails, no recipes, I think.
Huh, okay.
Yeah. Like food rants,
self-help,
maybe.
Though.
Food, yeah, maybe.
Adult coloring
self-help.
Books.
Yeah. Adult coloring books. I'd have to have Nastasia do them and then steal her ideas because Nastasia is the line drawing queen.
Oh yeah. Mm.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I could get my wife to do it, but that would be weird. It'd be easier. Like we could just come out with a book together, and I could just say, "Do this," and Nastasia would do the line drawings. One of the lesser known Nastasia Lopez skills.
Yeah, I never would have guessed that.
Yeah, no, it's true. Nastasia is a inveterate. Doodler, and you like working in pen, right?
Yeah, I do.
Like, not pencil, pen.
Pen.
Pen. She's a pen worker, likes pens. Although you don't like fancy pens. You don't give a rat's ass about fancy.
No,
rats behind, rather.
No.
Family show. About, you're like, you know, any old Bic will do.
No.
So, Jack, so now that we're all here, so tell us about the islands. You went to, which islands did you go to?
Edisto Island and St. Helena Island.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is that where, like, all the gullah stuff's happening?
Uh-huh, yeah. I got some frogmore stew.
Yeah? What's in frogmore stew?
It's, like, just shrimp that you have to peel yourself and, like, boiled potatoes and corn, that kind of thing.
Presumably, it doesn't taste like the Cape Cod version of that, though.
No, it did. Well, you know, I can't say that I've ever really spent much time in Cape Cod.
What?
Yeah.
Don't you live in the Northeast?
I know, it's weird, right?
What's your Cape Cod equivalent? What's your Northeast beach mentality?
Well, like
around?
I'm from Long Island, you know.
All right, so it's the same crap.
I guess so.
It's all the same crap. We're on Long Island?
I'm from a place called West Babylon, so it's like a South Shore border of Nassau, Suffolk, kind of right in the middle.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. You're not really a beach thing.
But you drive out to Montauk,
yeah,
and hang out with Billy Joel.
Wow!
Oh yeah. There,
you know, I've never been to Montauk.
I really don't like Billy Joel, actually.
You don't like? Whoa! What?
I'm sorry.
Whoa! Stas, you hear that?
I heard that.
I'm sorry, Stas.
Yeah,
Stas, huge Billy Joel fan.
Yeah,
I actually like. How
well, Stas from the West Coast, so it's like.
Yeah, but how can you come from Long Island and not like Billy Joel? Doesn't make any freaking sense.
Because I always hated Long Island, even when I was a kid.
Well, I mean, you know, I came from Jersey. You know, back in the day, that's where I went to elementary school. I still like Bon Jovi and Bruce Springsteen.
I was going to say, and Bruce, yeah?
Yeah. Well, I didn't like Bon Jovi at the time, but with age comes perspective on how kind of perfect Slippery When Wet is, like, almost like, you know, Moses came down and was like, Slippery When Wet. You know what I mean?
Wow.
It's like, when you think about the perfection of like the, it's like, you know, the childhood fans, it's awesome, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't like it at the time.
I'm more of a Springsteen fan than Bon Jovi, actually.
Yeah. Are you from Jersey?
No, I'm from New York.
Oh, well, yeah. So you get to look down on us folk who lived in... Where in New York originally?
I grew up in Harlem.
Oh, yeah, like real New York. Yeah, so you were one of those city kids that I hated.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Now my kids are those city kids. But I think I've said this before. I think it's a lot different now because you can be cool and like live in the suburbs now because of the internet.
Right, right. You can be cool anywhere these days.
Yeah, whereas back in the day, you know, we felt like losers. Like us suburban kids, we felt like losers. What about you and Covina, Stas?
Loser.
Although the internet was around when you were in high school, it happened? Too late, though, for you.
Senior year, yeah.
Yeah. The internet didn't happen until basically I was done with college.
I got email when I was in high school, but it was like internal email in the school.
I literally remember when like I saw the first email I'd ever seen. And by the way, you know, the guy that invented email just died like 2 days ago.
Really?
Yeah. I forget his name. He died. Like, he was like 74. He died like two days ago. And, you know, he popularized the at symbol, the whole thing, like invented email. I remember in like way before anyone had or cared about email, when there was like, you know, like 100 people with email addresses. I was a junior in high school. This is in like 87, 88, something like that. Mm-hmm. And this guy was like, I have this thing called email watch. And he like typed an email. And I was like, this is worthless. I was like, who's ever going to use this crap? This is garbage. Nonsense. Man.
Did he send it to you from his Apple Newton? That was early 90s, right?
We had 2E. It was an Apple 2E, which, of course, you know, I coveted because of the green screen.
Right,
was so much
right.
better than my Radio Shack TRS-80 computer. And but I just remember thinking, this is not going to go anywhere.
No.
This is worthless.
It's like watching TV on the internet.
Yeah, I forget that dude's name, but I hope he's a billionaire.
So
you know what
I'm
saying? Yeah. Anyway, he deserves it. You know, being an early adopter or something like email... You should win something for that.
Yeah, you probably get a cooler email address.
Yeah,
he's John 01 instead of John 387.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, obviously this is way pre... There was no www at that time. Literally, you had to, like, know exactly where someone was and send them an email. You know what I mean? Dumb. Okay. So you have anything you want to plug about the book? Anything specific you want to talk about?
No. I mean, I don't know. Buy it if you want to. Don't if you don't.
Yeah, anyway. Call in your questions to Kenji at 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. All right, so let's hit some stuff that we have here.
I actually, like, jump the line? Because I have something that I'm interested in hearing both of you talk about.
All right.
Is that cool?
Sure.
So there's all these articles about bay leaves. Mm-hmm. Lately that I've been reading, and kind of like challenging the notion that they actually do anything
right
in a big, you know, stat.
What do you mean? They taste like bay.
Yeah.
Have you seen this, Kenji? Have you seen these arguments?
I have had people ask me. I actually wrote an article like a couple years ago called it was a question I got from a reader, and the question was, what's the point of bay leaves?
Because they taste like bay.
They do, yeah. You can taste it, and of course, like, depending on where you get your bay leaves, whether it's like a Turkish bay leaf, which is what you generally find dried, versus like a California bay leaf, which you find fresh. Like, they have different flavors, but they definitely add flavor to dishes. You can tell the difference side by side if you taste.
They are merely the most popular of the aromatic leaves, which almost all of this style of aromatic tree leaf come from the laurel family, mm-hmm. right? So you have aromatic avocado leaves, where some aren't, which I believe are the same family as bay.
Are they?
I think. I don't know that they're all in the same family, but I know Lauraceae has, I'm pretty sure. I got to go look it up because I wasn't expecting to talk about it, but like, there's a lot of aromatic leaves in that kind of family. I don't know whether like sassafras and spicebush are in the same general family, but like a lot of those, you know, that family has these kind of aromatic leaves. And of course they make a difference. Now, the crappier the leaf is... Let me give you an example. I have some crappy, you know, spice class. That's a brand of spice right here. Spice class. So I have, like, crappy spice class bay leaves. And so I have to use, like, four or five times as many of those.
To get the same flavor.
To get the same flavor. And they're a pain. So I tend to tie them up by the
stem.
Yeah, and then throw them in like, larger quantities. But perhaps you've heard of the Spice Jack Old Bay, which is like has like a huge hit of ground up bay in it. Bay is...
To be clear, I can taste when bay leaves are used. I'm saying that there were a lot of articles posted. A lot of my friends were sharing. It was on the Owl.
But who wrote it? What's the Owl?
Yeah, well.
was it some like angry internet person just trying to make angry internet things?
It was like part humor, but also
who's
part
the owl?
Serious. It's a blog.
You know the one thing about bay leaves, though, is that this is different from most other herbs, is that, similarly to most other herbs, there is a big difference between dried and fresh. But the difference in bay leaves is that the dried versions are almost always the Turkish bay leaves, and the fresh versions are almost always California bay leaves, and they have a very different flavor. Like the California bay leaves have a much stronger sort of eucalyptus.
It's not the same plant, right?
Yeah, it's not even the same plant. Yeah. They're both sold as bay leaves. So a lot of people will say, oh, the fresh bay leaves are always better than the dry, but that's not always the case, because it adds a flavor that's quite different from a standard bay flavor. So I almost always use dry bay leaves that I store in the freezer.
Well, this is a huge misconception people have about everything in the world, that fresh is better than
dry.
They're almost always different. And so anything that is, sometimes something is different and worse. Yeah.
Sometimes it's just different.
Sometimes it's just different.
Like ginger. Like fresh ginger versus dried ginger.
Different.
They're totally different.
Dried basil, bad.
Dried basil, bad. Dried parsley. Dried chives, not good.
I haven't tried really dried chives. Freeze-dried chives I've had. You know what?
I'm talking if you go and buy a bottle of Spice Class.
Oh, Spice Class. You know, I got in big trouble with my wife because... Did I talk about this?
Maybe.
Because, I've been saying we've been doing the 70-style potato bars recently, you know, where you just make a big potato and then
it's like taco night.
Yeah, it's like taco night, but it's like big potato night, because I'm like, you know, whatever, we're bringing it back. And so my wife was cutting up the chives, and she did like the ultimate chive like horror show of chopping them long.
I kind of like that sometimes, like in a soup or something.
They have
like that,
no flavor when you chop them long. The chive flavor. Yeah, but then they stick in your teeth. I don't know. I'm not a... But you know what you shouldn't do? You shouldn't You shouldn't look at the chives that your wife has chopped and be like, what the hell are you doing to these chives? Why? Look, on a baked potato...
It's better than crushing them, at least.
Yeah,
with the dull knife.
Yeah.
That was the first, like, fancy restaurant job I had on my first day of service. I was chopping chives for the line, and I had no idea what I was doing then. And the chef, Barbara Lynch, is at Number 9 Park. The chef, like, she walked by my station while I was chopping the chives, and without even looking at me, like, just hearing the sound the chives were making as I was chopping them, she's like, you're doing those wrong. Throw them out, because she could hear the kind of crunch. Yeah, the crushing noise. The crushing noise, yeah. Because I was crushing them instead of slicing them.
Yeah. Well, I like thin, small discs, like two little tiny.
You want them to be sliced thinner than they are wide.
That's the best. Yeah. Although they're a pain to dose out like that, because they tend to stick and clump if you do it ahead. But that's life, big city. Yeah. Especially if you crush it. If
your knife is sharp and you slice well, then they stay nice and separate, I think.
Now let me ask you this: so chives, would you ever use? That's not true. So obviously, like, the application for blended chives is ranch dressing, right? So ranch dressing, dill, chives, other stuff. But in general, is chive ever – they're expensive. So is it worthwhile to ever – would you ever blend it, or would you use a different allium for that?
I wouldn't. I mean, you know, I've seen, like, chive oil, right? And you blend chives there. But
I never make it, though. Do you ever make that stuff?
No. I mean, I did.
It's there for color.
Like, I did in, like the early 2000s in restaurants, chive oil color on the soup.
But could you cheat on the chive oil and really use a different allium and scallion tops?
Probably. But, scallions taste a little different, don't they?
In the oil?
I don't know. Maybe they don't.
I think it's just one of those things that people used to do.
Maybe chives are a myth. Maybe there's no point in chives.
No, chives, they're good. Yeah. I like chives. Stas, you a chive fan?
Yeah.
Yeah, Stas likes the chive. Yeah. But anyway, this thing about bay. Who's the owl? Who's this blogger?
Who's the owl?
Do we know them?
No, we don't know them. Let's see. Can we call the
this
name?
This is like saying...
Kelly Conaboy.
This is like saying, we have, wine. Flavor? You're like, yeah, wine has a flavor. What are you talking about? Bay leaf. Did this person have, a negative experience with bay leaves? Do they think it's a scam? Are these, the kind of people that don't like modern art because they think the wool is being pulled over their eyes?
It could be someone who has your Spice Class bay leaves who use one bay leaf in a soup and don't notice it because it's a shitty bay leaf.
That's
right.
True.
I think that's the issue.
Bad bay leaf.
I do think that's the issue.
Yeah, then fine. The answer is use more. The good thing about bay is that... most recipes tell you to use a bay leaf or two, and that won't really do much with most of the bay leaves, the low-quality bay leaves that people have. So I invariably triple the amount that the recipe calls for. And bay leaf is not the kind of thing that rides, unless you go way over, it doesn't really ride over the top.
Right.
But like, you can't, like, I never make a stock without bay.
I very rarely make like a super stew or anything like that without bay in it.
Yeah.
Rarely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's good. And like the whole point of it is it's an integrative spice. So it's not supposed to, it's not like Nastasia's least favorite cumin, which is like supposed to hit you on the head. You know what I mean?
Right. It boosts other flavors pretty well.
Stas, why don't you like cumin?
I don't know.
We've gone through it before. I don't want
to. I know. There was a comment in the chat room. They said, how about getting Kenji to talk about his vegan month just for Nastasia's benefit?
All right, but before we do that, Jack, I had a comment in on the Twitter from a geek girl with a number, which I forget the number. Okay. Anyway, she wants to know how to get on the chat rooms because apparently we're not making it like clear how to get onto the chat rooms.
Oh, it's clear how to get in the chat rooms.
Well, tell her how to get on the freaking chat rooms. How do you
think
do it?
This person emailed this and then said they could figure it out. So you go to the website, you click play,
okay.
And then it's going to pop up with a player, and then
you have to play the chats. They're like a recording.
No, you have to pull up the live stream first, and then you know, you just click on the Heritage Radio logo right there, and it pulls up the chat room.
There you go.
You could also go to Mixlr.com/Heritage-Radio-Network if you want to go manual with it there.
Mixlr.
That's the
sounds like a Flintstones character.
Kind of does. I have a caller if you want to take the call.
All right, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave and Kenji. It's Alex from Santa Barbara.
How's it going?
And I was wondering, settle a debate for me about the liquid smoke brine versus actually smoking, because it's been coming up a lot that you can get pretty close to there with liquid smoke and a little bit of nitrate in your brine for, let's say, 48 hours, and then you low temp out for 36 on, let's say, you know, a brisket.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically the same. And I don't believe it, but I've never done a side-by-side. And I want you guys to explain the math to me.
But who said it was the same?
Like chef steps and or close enough to be the same.
Yeah.
And
I've,
some of my friends
I've said
done
similar
it.
Things. Not I said similar things in a sous vide pork rib recipe I wrote a couple months ago. It's not exactly the same, and it's not exactly the same in the same way that like anything you cook sous vide is not going to be exactly the same as something you cook via another method, right? Like sous vide brisket is sous vide brisket. It's not exactly the same as barbecue brisket.
Not at all the same.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean, I don't think that means better or worse. But as far as the smoke flavor goes, I mean, you can get smoke flavor from a liquid smoke brine. That will make people think that it was smoked.
Well, I mean,
you don't get like bark development, things like that. But it is literally the same stuff that is getting deposited on your meat while you're smoking it,
minus some stuff. And,
right.
And usually you get
my question right there.
Yeah,
where it's like, what's the minus stuff that we're missing? Because I could taste the difference. I mean, I know you're going to get different products depending on how you cook it, but just the flavor of the smoke.
They get rid of a lot of the theoretically cancer causing like polycyclic hydrocarbon stuff, right? Isn't that like
I think
they,
so? Yeah.
And then they also, you know, the issue is usually you're in an oil phase or a water phase because most they're not so like presumably some is gonna like some smoke compounds like would gravitate towards the oil phase versus the water, so you're probably only getting the water phase stuff.
Right,
and stuff that
but when you're smoking in a smoker, you're mostly getting only water phase stuff anyway because the smoke is being transported by the moist air, right?
Well, there's actual particulate matter as well.
Right. There's some. Yeah.
You know, and so like you know, I noticed like you know when the chefs used to use a smoking gun. Do they use that anymore?
I think some people do.
Yeah, you would notice that like the particulate matter would settle out after a couple of minutes, but the smoke aroma would stay in the thing because there is like a heavy kind of a particulate thing. But I mean, the truth of the matter is that smoking does a number of things besides imparting flavor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're being exposed to a particular atmosphere, you're being exposed to a particular temperature at a particular humidity, and so, you know, like Kenji was saying, like you get the bark. So different things happen from a textural standpoint that are a lot of times difficult to separate from just the flavor element,
yeah.
And especially with things like crust development, it's virtually impossible to separate the textural difference and the cooking difference from the flavor. It's just not possible.
Right, right.
And the other thing to be aware of is that liquid smoke is produced at a very specific temperature for a very specific thing. So you smoking something for real might be different if your temperatures are high or lower. You're using different – because you're going to generate different kinds of compounds because pyrolysis is very, very complicated stuff is happening. The other thing is – that I find that like smoke applications, more maybe with powder than with the liquids, it's super easy to overdose on it and it goes like bitter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And people, I think people do often overdose on smoke, but I think people often also overdose on smoke when they're actually smoking things too.
Right.
Because I always think, I mean, the smoke should be seasoning like cumin or bay leaf or whatever. You know, it should be seasoning. It shouldn't be the only thing you taste in there. But I will tell you that, you know, in the testing I've done for you know, getting smoke flavor into meat through methods that aren't smoking, that brining in a brine with liquid smoke, I think is the most effective way to keep it subtle and to get good penetration without, you know, it's very different to do that than to say like add liquid smoke straight to like a barbecue sauce, which you just paint on the surface. Like brining it overnight in a brine with liquid smoke gets you a much more sort of natural tasting smoke penetration.
I'm gonna get my behind kicked. I don't really like barbecue sauce.
Well, what kind? Like Kansas City? Like sweet,
I don't know. I just don't. I don't like goopy. Yeah, I don't like goopy.
Yeah, I'm more of like a vinegar sauce.
Yeah. I don't even consider like I know that they do. I consider that like red pepper and vinegar. Like I don't consider
that.
Yeah,
red pepper,
like,
vinegar, a little sugar maybe. But yeah,
I don't consider that like bit. When someone says barbecue sauce, you're thinking
Kansas City style ketchup and molasses.
Yeah,
right? Yeah. Like, I'm not a huge fan of that.
I like it on French fries.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I think it's okay as, like, you know, kind of a secondary ketchup.
Yeah.
But I just not...
I'm with you on that, too.
Yeah.
And people love it. I'm going to get my... I'm happy that you like it, whoever you are that likes it.
Yeah, right.
I'm not against it in theory. It's just not my... It's not my cup of tea on meat.
I have another caller.
Sure.
Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, Dave. Dan, Seattle. A couple of pressure canner questions.
Okay.
So first of all, I got a big new all aluminum pressure canner for Christmas.
Made by American Canner Corp.
Yep.
Yep.
So my first question is, can I make the stock in it before I put it in jars? I mean, does the bare aluminum really matter much for stock?
Well, it depends on what you believe. Like, if you believe that aluminum is bad to cook in, then it matters. If you don't, as I don't, then, you know, it won't bother you.
I mean, flavor-wise, I don't think you're going to taste aluminum in your...
Not in the stock.
Yeah, not in the stock.
Okay. I'm not talking about anything with a ton of lemon juice or vinegar or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, the hard part about even, like, small amounts of, like... you know, in some classic stocks, it'll be like a couple tomatoes, but it's not going to do anything. You know what I mean? But the I wouldn't use. I guess you can't fit it in the dishwasher anyway because it's so big. I was going to say like where you don't want to do on that is like harsh detergents on it because it's. I believe it's cast, and so it'll get porous and pitted after a while at the bottom. And but I cook.
Yeah, they specifically say not to do that. And like you said, it wouldn't fit anyway. I mean, it's a monstrously huge thing.
Yeah, I mean the hard part about the pressure canners, if you're using them to do anything other than straight canning, is that they are a huge ship to steer. So. You know, on a level of difficulty of getting the right heat input, I'd say it's like twice as difficult as like with a regular pressure cooker to get the heat input correct.
Just because of its volume, you mean?
Yeah, just because it's so hard to read the,
right.
The slope right. You know, whereas like a normal pressure cooker responds within a minute or two, like this guy could have like, you know, 4 or 5 minutes of ride
right.
up and down.
Right.
So it takes a while to kind of dial it in. So like what I would do... is the first couple times you use it, I would kind of keep track of where your settings are based on how much you have in it, because that's pretty much, you know, assuming that you use relatively constant loads.
Yeah.
Also, that thing's a pain. You ever use one of those things, Kenji?
Mm-mm.
They're a pain to close. All of those screws. I mean, look.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those.
Nothing else can do what they can do. They're huge volume.
Right.
You know, pressure cooker canners. But do you have the regular canner lid or do you have the sterilization lid for it?
The what?
Do you have the regular canning lid for it or the sterilization lid with the tube?
The regular.
Yeah, yeah. The sterilization lid is creepy. It's
how does that work?
So they're really, if you're going to use it as a sterilizer, which I guess some people do in places I don't know where who don't have right. sterilizers, they're worried that there'll be pockets of gas in it that will cause it to not go through the sterilization procedure at the same way. So they have a tube that extends down that you have to like vent out the tube to get rid of entrained non-steam gases before you crank the stuff. But remember what a nightmare that was to us?
Yep.
And we crushed a tube and we were yelling at each other and screaming and nightmare. Nightmare.
I use like pretty much exclusively electric pressure cookers now.
Really?
Yeah. You know,
which one?
I'm using the Breville Pro, which has like full manual. It only goes up to 12 PSI, which most electric cookers do, but you can get anywhere from 1.5 to 12 at half PSI increments.
Can you hack it like the Cuisinart?
I don't know. I haven't tried.
Yeah.
But it also has like automatic altitude adjustment and like an automatic pressure release and stuff, which is pretty nice.
Automatic altitude adjustment. So it'll go. So yeah, that's not worth it. I was gonna say you could put it into another container, jack it like to 3 PSI, and then hit go. But that's not
right.
It's not worth it. It's not worth it. So it's actually working on pressure, not on temperature.
It has a pressure gauge, and it also has two temperature gauges. Like it has a temperature probe at the bottom and at the top.
But the pressure gauge is a release, or the pressure gauge is a measurement.
I'm not sure. Actually, I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't know. I should ask them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the altitude bit
second,
works.
Second, much more specific question.
Okay.
I want to make cochinita pibil in a canning jar. Can I just put the banana leaf and the pork, I mean, whatever, like the toughest piece of pork I can get, and the achiote in there? And is there some overwhelmingly obvious reason that wouldn't work?
I don't know. What do you think, Kenji?
I think it would work. I mean,
what happens to banana leaves in a pressure cooker?
They probably break down. I don't know. I've never tried that specifically, but I've stuck. I've stuck meats and like onions and things. Like you can make like. You know, you caramelize onions inside sealed right. jars in a pressure canner.
Right, but onions obviously lose a lot of their onion potency. They get a lot more neutral and a lot sweeter in a pressure cooker
right.
than they would in any sort of other normal cook.
Sure, yeah.
If you were going to do like acid canning where it's just a boil out versus pressure. But I don't. In other words, I don't know whether banana leaves are going to have a different flavor extraction or anything around the. Because, you know, there's that layer around the banana leaf that has that particular flavor.
Banana leafy flavor.
Yeah, which I like. But I don't know what happens at pressure cooker.
I don't know. I know how you can find out.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but there's nothing on the surface of it that seems to think that it won't work.
All right, well, I will just give that a shot next time I get around to it. I wound up with way too many banana leaves the last time I made this regularly.
All right, yeah.
I need to get them out of my freezer.
All right, well, let us know what happens.
Cool. Thanks, sir.
Thanks. I got a question from the chat room if you want to take it.
Yeah, sure. Okay, go.
Yep, to Kenji or Dave, can you ramenize fresh pasta? Also, instead of doing the baking soda technique, can I just use kintsugi? I don't know if that's
yes.
how you pronounce it.
Yes and yes.
Okay, there you go.
But I don't know that you'd want. I mean, it depends on what you like, why you're doing it.
He said he used the modernist cuisine recipe for ramen and broke a pasta machine.
Because it was too dry, or...
No, I don't know.
Oh, wait. So specifically, the question is it going to go through his pasta machine?
I guess so. Can you ramenize fresh pasta?
Oh.
Yes. Yes. I mean, obviously, this is how they make ramen.
Is he asking, can you make fresh Italian-style pasta and cook it in baking soda water, and will it taste like pasta?
No, ramen? I think he's saying, can you do yellow alkaline noodles...
Through a regular pasta machine.
I mean, I would assume you can.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah.
But the question is like, if you're going to make an Italian shape, I mean, like, look, fundamentally, yellow alkaline noodles is like a fairly normal pasta dough with kintsugi in it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, typically a little bit drier than an Italian style dough, but.
Yeah, but
so
I mean.
Maybe harder to push through a pasta machine, but I don't.
Right, but you could up the water, you could still get the yellow, some of the bounce, and the kintsugi flavor. But it'll taste like that, so you're basically just making ramen in a different shape.
Yeah, there's you know, like Yuji Ramen, he does like a bunch of different pasta shapes with ramen dough. So he makes like ramen flavored orecchiette and stuff like that.
Right, the key thing, the real baller move is to do, forget making freaking noodles. Make a lasagna so that it retains its texture when it's being cooked. I mean, that's the baller thing to do.
And then slice it afterwards, or just...
Yeah, no, but like, in other words, instead of using like Italian-style pasta for... although, you know, who makes... You don't really want to use fresh for lasagna anyway, unless it's a very specific thing.
But you would want
a dried ramenized, but not like fried and pre-cooked ramenized, unless you're going to do the thing. But like, what's an application for pasta where you really want that, the texture, the bounce, right? Where
ramen.
Pasta tends to disintegrate. Ramen. Yeah. But that's the reason to ramenize something.
Yeah.
For ramen.
Chicken noodle soup that you're going to put in a can.
Yeah.
He specifies, he says, what I'm asking is to make fresh Italian noodles, then ramenize.
So you mean using that hack where you cook it in water, like with baking soda or kansui, and it gets a little bit of that ramen, like that ramen flavor.
You can get the flavor. I don't think you're going to get the texture.
Well, with dry pasta, you do get the texture is different.
Really?
Significantly. Yeah. But I've never tried it with fresh pasta, but I don't see why it wouldn't work with fresh pasta.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I would bet it would be more likely to work if you did the pre-soak and then bring up from cold than if you did it, because once the protein's cooked, it's cooked.
Yeah, I mean, maybe with fresh pasta, the problem would be that it doesn't spend enough time in there because it cooks so quickly and it's not absorbing much of the liquid, right?
So how close to ramen do you get if you're boiling it in water with...
If you do like a thin pasta, like spaghetti or cappellini or something, and cook it in water with baking soda, like it gets pretty close.
In flavor or in texture?
Both.
Really?
Yeah.
It's
a good trick for if you're making like, if you want to make like a pasta salad that where the pasta doesn't get mushy, you know, because pasta, when you make, I mean, I don't know why people make pasta salad anyway, but if you make pasta salad, huh? But it gets mushy as it sits in the dressing. If you cook it in like alkalized water, is that the right word?
Alkalized
water, yeah. The pasta stays a lot bouncier even after you cool it and dress it.
Let me tell you something about angel hair and all those small pastas. They're supposed to be creamy.
Yeah, but if you want them to be ramen and you can't get ramen where you are.
So when do I like those things dry? I guess there are anchovy sauces for Christmas Eve where I like those pastas dryish.
Mm-hmm.
How do you like your very fine pasta sauce?
I don't like fine pasta.
Yeah,
for real?
Me neither.
Why?
Because it's bad.
This is what I hate about people. It's not bad. It's just different. It's not your al dente stuff. It's just a different product.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
God damn. I mean, gosh darn.
Yeah.
I also know a good way to find out if you can do this, by the way.
Yes. The good old test it and see what happens.
Caller on the line.
Oh, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Scooter in Montana. Kenji, you may have just answered a question I asked a couple weeks ago about canning noodles. So I called and asked about getting noodles that are like those, you know, the canned chicken noodles.
Yeah.
You think if you add some alkaline to your homemade noodles and put them in the can that they'll hold together?
I think hold together better. But I would cook the noodles separately in alkalized water and then add them to the soup before you can it. I wouldn't add baking soda to your chicken noodle soup. But I would cook the noodles separately.
Yeah.
Or if you're making homemade noodles, yeah, you could add kansui or baking soda or something to them.
Right. Yeah.
Sweet. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
So now, Jack, what was the other question you had off of the?
I've got two chat room requests.
Right.
I'm going to let you choose your own adventure here.
Okay.
They either want a conversation on Vegan Month, comparing Vegan Month notes, or revisiting the conversation about weighing cocktail ingredients.
Oh, okay.
Well,
could do either of those.
Well, here, hit it on the Vegan Month. Let's talk about Vegan Month.
Okay, wait. Comparing notes, as in what?
I did raw vegan for a week.
Vegan. Okay.
I know, but you did. What do you do? Vegan.
I do it every year. Every year for a month.
Are you in the middle of that month right now?
I'm in the middle of it right now. Yeah.
So, what's up with that?
I started it, you know, mainly, well, I've always been interested in vegan. Like, as far as diets go, it's one of the ones that makes sense to me, just sort of from a ethical and environmental standpoint. It's made sense to me. But the first time I did it, I was sort of skeptical, and I did it mainly because I wanted to challenge myself and see what would happen. And then it turned out that I actually had a really great month because it made me think about recipes in a different way, think about new ingredients and new techniques. I think from a recipe development standpoint, it's been great because it means like for a month out of the year, I think about a completely different set of things than I normally do. But these days, you know, when I'm not testing recipes or eating for work, I maintain mostly vegetarian, some fish, but I don't really go out for meat anymore. So, you know, in that sense, it's sort of changed the way I eat.
So what's your favorite thing you've discovered this vegan month?
I've been working a lot on hummus, and I, you know, I was actually going to be publishing a recipe next week, but then last night I went to John Fraser's new place, Nick's. Have you been there?
No. Nope.
It's awesome. Awesome. It opened on Monday. It's a vegetarian restaurant, but John, you know, John Fraser, he has Dovetail and Narcissa. Yeah. Neither one of them vegetarian restaurants. He's like, you know, great chef, Michelin star guy.
Good man too.
Yeah. But and he opened a vegetarian restaurant that is amazing, and they have this awesome hummus. And I was talking to him about it, and he uses a completely different technique than I use. So now maybe I'm going to hold off on the recipe and do some more testing.
What do you do?
So you know, the testing I was doing was mainly about getting the texture right, and so doing things like trying to peel, whether peeling chickpeas really matters. My technique now is basically just like cook the crap out of the chickpeas, and then puree it all. But what he does is he cooks the crap out of the chickpeas, but then completely reduces the liquid, and purees all the mirepoix and basically everything that was in the pot, all the liquid, all the mirepoix, everything that was in there with the chickpeas, purees it all together. And purees it while it's hot in a blender, as opposed to letting it cool and then doing it in a food processor. Because when it's hot, it's like the texture of like a milkshake, you know, it's like easily done in a blender. And then by the time it cools down to serving temperature, it's the texture of hummus. So you can get it a lot smoother in a blender than you can in a food processor.
Because of setback?
Yeah.
So are you an advocate? Is he an advocate of the peel after soak? Rub the things off after soak?
No. So, I mean, okay, so where I'm coming down, and again, this might change if I do some more testing, but where I was coming down in it up until I had his last night was that, when I served it side by side to people, people mostly picked the one where they were peeled. But the other one was also way better than, you know, the one where you just cook them to crap was way better than anything else as well. So it's like you can get like 90% good hummus without peeling the chickpeas if you want that extra 10%.
You know what though? Peeling chickpeas is not that big.
It's not that hard. Yeah. No. You do like the gold panning method, right?
Also I just like put my hands and I'm like,
exactly.
After it soaks and then
you put them in water, rub them around with your hands and then kind of skim off the skins that flip to the top.
I find it strangely cathartic.
You know, some people don't like doing stuff like that. The one thing you don't want to use is canned chickpeas. I mean,
in a pinch, they taste okay.
In a pinch, they taste okay. And again, you know, this is like in side by side taste tests. They don't taste okay, but nobody eats things side by side in real life.
Do you ever do it with like the smaller like Bengal gram stuff, or you know, only using Italian style?
I've been using just Italian style.
Hummus so hot right now. Hummus
so hot.
So hot right now. Yeah. Hummus. I don't know if you know this. This is years ago. I had to do raw vegan for a week, and it was a horror show. This is a complete horror show.
Well, the raw part is
I was just angry, and
the part that doesn't make much sense.
I was an angry monster, and when I went back on cooked food, my toilet thanked me. And by the way, we haven't talked about this, but you know Richard Wrangham, the guy who wrote How Cooking Made Us Human.
Nope, but
oh, he's awesome. He's a professor at Harvard,
oh, I know that book. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Why the actual title's out of my head? I just have the tagline "On Fire," I think, or something. So he's done a lot of amazing work on like primates and like how long we would have to sit and eat to get nutrition from raw food diets and things like this. So he's going to come on the show. We're trying to schedule it. We're not sure when, but he's going to come on the show. We're going to talk to him about his book and how it relates to kind of cooking. But raw food.
Well, these days, a lot of people do have time to sit around and eat a lot, right?
He reviewed some of the data that was done on people on raw food diets and kind of how much they had to eat. And it's a great way to lose weight just because your body can't absorb a lot of the stuff that you're eating. So it's just a fantastic way to, to lose weight.
2 minutes, Dave.
2 minutes. All right. So you want to talk about I have to read an anti-me rant and then
talk about wing cocktails.
You know, okay. Let's do cocktails and then I'll rip through the anti-me rant.
Okay, Wang cocktails. So I think I tweeted once a while back that why don't more people weigh their cocktail ingredients instead of measuring them in jiggers? And then some people said yes, and then some people rightfully said no, that's stupid. But I think really it comes down to context. Like, if you know, like I know what drinks I drink at home, and it's not a huge, like, I maybe make four or five different drinks at home, or like most of the time it's just a Negroni, right? And if I'm making like three or four of them, I find it's easier just to throw the thing on the scale, pour the stuff in, and I'm done. And I know the ratio. Like, I don't have to care about the density of the things, because I know how much I want of each one, and it's done. And I don't have to mess up a jigger. I just pour it into the glass. And
no,
that's
but
it.
You always have to pour into another glass, because what if you overpour?
Well, you just don't overpour.
Well, remember, you never pour the liquid directly into the batch. It's not like cooking. I
pour it directly into my mixing glass.
You're a freaking savage. You're a freaking savage. Like, you have no room for mistakes then.
And it's also, if I slightly overpour, I just don't care, right?
Savage. Like, then why weigh at all? Just do it by eye.
That's a good question, I guess.
Anyway, let's read the anti.
The illusion of precision.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of times that's the case. Anyway, a lot of the stuff is just making yourself feel good with precision.
With cooking, no. Like this, I wrote a rant a bit about, like, recipes that have gram measurements in very, very precise amounts, and it's like, use 33 grams of onions and stuff, and that's, like, I think total illusion of precision, because it's not like the onion I'm using today is the same as the onion I'm using next week, or the one that you're getting in California or whatever, right? It's like, you can use the same exact amount of ingredients and come up with completely different flavors just because ingredients vary a lot, but for some reason there are some people who, like, really want this kind of precision in a recipe, even if it's a sort of false precision.
How often do you use a thermometer? When you're not testing for writing.
So these days, not much, because I don't cook meat very much at home. But when I cooked meat, I always use it for meat.
Even when you roast a chicken? You use a thermometer on a chicken?
Oh, I especially use it for roast chicken, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because roast chicken is one of those things where I think if it gets slightly overcooked, it's not good anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Chicken and turkey are
probably... Oh, because you're not a briner.
I'm a dry briner. Yeah.
We need another whole other show to get into these kind of arguments. Jack, can I read this anti-me rant real quick?
Real quick.
Jack, thanks for the wonderful network. I am a big fan and admirer of Dave. That said, this is about the GAPS diet. Do you know about the GAPS diet, Kenji?
No.
That said, I have to admit that I'm rather disturbed that Dave got off topic to evaluate the GAPS diet for his listeners. I didn't evaluate it, by the way. I just said that I don't have any data on it, I don't know about it, but that things that I saw initially on it set off red flags, but not that I had the data. That was maybe long and didn't actually make the point, but that was what I was trying to say, is that flags were being raised about the presentation of the diet, but that I have no actual data on the diet. That was my take home, by the way, just so you know, Kenji.
All right.
I'm going to have to familiarize it. I say Justino instead of Jesus Christ, should make it a little more family friendly.
Okay.
Justino, where in the list of many things he's an expert on is human physiology and healing diets? The question should have been discarded as off topic and never brought to the fore. But it has been, and Dave didn't even know where to begin talking about it, which is kind of what I said. I don't know about this specific diet. I do know about some fad diets, like Master Cleanse, a load of horse crap. Unless you love it, people, in which case, anyway. Bottom line is that this is a healing diet with a long history of success and a lot of endorsements from qualified medical professionals. Amazingly, it addressed problems with human microbiome before anyone was thinking of the human microbiome. If Dave will check all those ailments that GAPS says it cures, all are identified by reports as ailments that are triggered by gut dysbiosis, autism, a bunch of things, more like associated with, you know, most of the data. Anyway, triggered by gut dysbiosis, GAPS fixes those problems and fixes them by just changing diet for a while. Justino, it doesn't really have to be, it doesn't have any products to sell, unlike real fad diets usually do. Usually, not always. Master Cleanse. anyway, if you would like to have an author of a popular level GAPS diet book on the air with Dave, I could arrange it. While I think he should never comment on food as medicine issues again, since it's really not his area of expertise, I do feel that he owes it to his listeners and GAPS people to set the record straight as much as possible. The easy way would be to have an established commenter on the diet. Come on. Happy to arrange that. I'll still listen every week, of course, even if Dave was just packing sugar, honey, and iced tea when he addressed that topic. Let me know. Thanks. Alan Balliet from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Yeah, I'll have someone on, but I mean, I may look, we'll see how much I know when the expert comes on, and we'll see whether or not, we'll see what happens. I'm happy to have someone on, and I would love someone to come on and tell me that, you know, the red flags that are raised when I look at it are not red flags, and that I'm, you know, a bad or unknowledgeable person.
You typically don't talk about diet and health much, right?
I was asked specifically about it. I avoid it, not because I don't think about it, but because in general, I think most proscriptive diet plans are horse hockey.
Yeah.
Unless someone proves to me otherwise, my general idea is because the human body is so freaking complex that most of the data that people rely on, and this is not I'm not talking off the top of my head here. This is based on not specifically the GAPS diet because I haven't read about it, but like much wading through horse, like scientific horse hockey on many different diet things, salt, MSG, auto intoxication, the whole load of horse crap that we've been handed by people over the past 150 years. I'm extremely cautious about people telling people that how they can change their lives by manipulating the extraordinarily complex and poorly understood system that is the human body.
Right.
Fair enough. We have to end, Dave. Thank you so much, Kenji, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Kenji.
The book is The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, available everywhere. That's it, Dave.
All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.